Hey, it's Dave Asprey. Before we get to today's episode, let's talk a little bit about online dating. Because it's a little known fact that in 1991, I might have been one of the first people to have an online date because I hacked a cute girl's terminal when I worked at the computer labs at UC Santa Barbara so I could figure out who she was, and well, we did end up dating for a few months. So that was an online date, but that was back when it wasn't cool. Because with Valentine's Day coming up, there isn't a better time to take advantage of the internet to find your perfect match now that we have big data and algorithms and things like that. It's way more efficient than going to a bar, and there's no alcohol, so you don't have to worry about a hangover wrecking your performance the next day. So I recommend eHarmony because you actually have pretty good odds of finding a match. They deliver over 10 million matches daily, and 600,000 couples who met on eHarmony have actually tied the knot. That's about 4% of all US marriages, which is pretty amazing for one website. And the founder of eHarmony was actually a clinical psychologist, so you're getting the benefit of over 30 years of research into what makes successful relationships work, all in an app that you can use online or even on your phone. And that's pretty cool. You don't have to worry about all your friends seeing that you're looking either, because you have to be a member on the site and see a match to have each other's photos, so none of this swipe right, swipe left kind of thing. Head on over to eHarmony.com and enter the promo code JANUARYLOVE to save 50% off the regular price for a 6-month membership. That's eHarmony.com, JANUARYLOVE.
Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
Hey, it's Dave Asprey with Bulletproof Radio. Thank you for listening to the show. If you subscribe to the show on iTunes and just take a minute to leave a review, if I read your review on the air, I'll send you some Bulletproof coffee as a thank you. Totally appreciate it when you let people know that the show's helping. Today's cool fact of the day is that the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is known as the master clock for controlling our 24-hour circadian rhythm, is actually in your brain, as you'd expect. It's a wing-shaped part of the brain, and it controls the production of melatonin, which comes out of your pineal gland. And melatonin is famous for putting you to sleep, but did you know melatonin also lowers your risk of cancer, and it also helps you detox a few things in your body? This is not well known, but melatonin is pretty important biologically, not just for sleep. Long before Bulletproof, I worked at one of the companies that pioneered cloud computing as we know it today. And years later, it's amazing to see what companies like Carbonite are doing with that technology. Carbonite Cloud Backup lets you securely save your photos, music, documents, and other important files automatically, so you'll always have a copy even if you lose your computer or you spill Bulletproof coffee or some other Bulletproof drink all over your keyboard. It's a great digital insurance policy for anything digital that you don't want to leave to chance, and it's already trusted by more than 1.5 million people and small business customers. Go to carbonite.com/bulletproof and you can get a free trial without even giving them your credit card. And when you use the offer code bulletproof, you'll get 2 free bonus months if you decide to stay. That's carbonite.com/bulletproof. Today's guest on the show is a physician, a researcher, and a teacher in light medicine and photobiology, which is why I was just talking about melatonin. He's particularly interested in how light affects our brains and our bodies, and he looks at solar radiation and artificial light sources and what they do to our hormones. That's particularly interesting because I've been saying for years that fluorescent lights in offices are actually bad for us, and here's a guy who's been researching that and can shed some light on the subject. His name is Alexander Wunsch, and he's coming live on Bulletproof Radio from Germany. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Dave. Good to hear you.
How did you get into looking at what light does to the body? This is a pretty esoteric field, but you're working with, as a consultant to federal authorities in the lighting industry, like you've become somewhat of an expert in this. How does one become an expert in photobiology?
So it was a kind of weird way because it started with a kind of esoteric aspect of photobiology. I started with the Dinsha spectrochrome system. I was, after my studies of medicine, I was quite disappointed because everything spins around pharmaceutical stuff, and I was looking for some physiological means to influence the body in a quite natural way. And I, since I don't like hard chemistry so much, I stumbled over the spectrochrome system.
What is the spectrochrome system? What does it do?
The spectrochrome system is a color therapy or chromotherapy system invented or established by Dinshar Gadyali, who, if you look it up on the web, you will find out that some people think that he's fraudulent. He was a fraudulent guy, but I didn't care about these things. I looked into his system, and the great thing in his chromotherapy system is that he made a blend of Newton's spectrum, rainbow spectrum on one hand, and Goethe's spectrum, the more psychological spectrum, on the other hand. And he blended these two systems together to a quite amazing color circle consisting of 12 different colors, which are very useful to control physiological reactions. For example, via the retinothalamical hypothalamical tractus. You already mentioned the inner clock, the body clock, melatonin, the pituitary gland is the counter actor of the pineal gland. And using these colors, and I was quite, the first experience I had was with a skin burn, and it just healed up like that. It just took less than 2 weeks, and it was a 2 to 3 degree skin burn. And I didn't see this during my studies at the university before. And Dinshar's idea was to, he was talking about different kinds of proof levels. And the highest level of proof you can get is the direct proof. And this means if you make an experience, if you experience a method, in the end you become an expert, one who did the experience. And I just tried it, and this is the big advantage with the chromotherapy, that it's harmless on one hand, on the other hand it's quite effective, and you can test it, you can try it on your own. And this is how I got into chromotherapy, and it just fit into my picture of the scientific world quite perfectly well, because it was consistent with my physicist's view on one hand and with the physician's view on the other hand. And this is how I got into photobiology in the first go.
It's, I believe it to be the case that light is a drug. And some light has very little impact on the body, but some has a lot. And I've also used different colors of light, monochromatic colors sometimes, which means just a single wavelength, in order to change healing levels, to actually get into the brain, to change mitochondrial function. And you said something, though, that a lot of people say that this work is fraudulent based. Where did the idea that using colored light on humans is fraud, where did that originate? And you know, how do you respond to those types of claims?
I think the root or the first encounter humans had with colors is a pretty long time ago. When we think about our ancestors, the monkeys, for example, they learned about 23 million years ago to handle the color codes. Before there was the pheromone system for social interaction, and you can tell from analysis from the genes of monkeys that about 23 million years ago it changed from pheromone signaling to color signaling. So colors are a kind of universal code which is valid throughout our earthly universe, because everywhere you have colors. For example, what's quite amazing, that the wavelengths of the colors of the rainbow pretty much are in coherence or with the smallest organelles in our cells. So, for example, mitochondria, they have a size between 500 nanometers and 2000 nanometers. And other cell organs have different sizes, which can be linked to, directly linked to the dimensions of the wavelengths of the different colors. And so in German, as a German word, Farbe means color, and it means character of a thing, character of an organism, character of a plant. And so it describes pretty good what color really means. It's a universal code, and the colors tell our metabolical system, for example, tell our vegetative system how to attune the ratio between sympathetic and parasympathetic activity, for example.
Okay. What about the effect of light on our hormones? There's something you've called vitamin D, a chronobiological stress hormone. What does that mean? How do you view light and vitamin D in the body?
Vitamin D is a kind of chemical signal for the inner cells in our system, because only the eye connects us to the outer visual environment and non-visual environment, radiation environment, so to say. And the skin is pretty much connected to our radiation environment as well, even better than the eye, by the way. But how to tell all the inner cells? You cannot connect each and every cell with little nerve fibers to the brain stem, for example, or to the midbrain, in order to control their activity. You have to use, or our body, our organism has to use different kinds of information transmission. So one way to inform cells is a nerve signal, of course, but the other way is to use hormones. And vitamin D is a very old molecule which can be found in very early plants, even in some bacteria. And the task is to signal to the cell in a chemical way that there is ultraviolet radiation outside. And as always in nature or in evolution, if we are surrounded by a potentially bad thing, evolution tries to make the best out of it and tries to compensate for the negative aspects by using other aspects of this molecule. And so the organisms learned to decode the chemical signal for UV in the environment in a proper way to have a better living and to survive.
What do you think about ultraviolet B and ultraviolet A and the different spectrums of non-visible light? Are those important for this hormone signaling mechanism that you work with?
Just think about UVB, which is the sharpest radiation we get here on ground Earth. And this UVB has the highest biological impact in a way that, for example, think about a skin burn, think about a sunburn. You get the sunburn in nature only from UVB. And what is the consequence if humans are exposed to UVB-containing radiation? Is that a severe sunburn would be a kind of hazard. And in order to prevent this hazard, it's a good idea for the cells in the body, for the organs in the body, to know about this environmental factor. And you ask me if I think if it's a good or bad. I don't think that nature works like that. We have good aspects, we have bad aspects, and it's our brain, it's our intelligence which turns it in a way that we can suck the honey from the things and avoid the bad aspects.
How important is it that we receive full spectrum sunlight versus, say, being behind a window or using other kinds of lighting?
Since there is signaling, we have photochemical signaling throughout the whole spectrum. We have, for example, for the UVB part, there's the vitamin D. For the UVA part, we have nitric oxide, for example. But there are other kinds of biochemical signaling going on in the blood, in the bloodstream, under the influence of UVA light. And I think for our body, for this complicated metabolism, when you just look at a single cell, we are not able to understand what really goes on there. But when we think about billions of cells like we have in our body, you have to attune everything. And the ratio between the UVB and the UVA and the visible light and the near-infrared and even the longer wavelengths, the infrared B and C, for example, everything has its purpose in terms of attuning our body to that it perfectly matches the environment, the actual environment we are in.
Okay.
And talking about other kinds of light sources, as humans, we think we can do everything better than nature. And for example, the physicist, he thinks that the heat rays emitted by an incandescent lamp are unnecessary. And in fact, for pure vision, ad hoc vision, it's not really necessary. But it will have consequences if you remove parts of the spectrum, because our body is attuned to the full spectrum of sunlight on one hand and thermal light sources on the other hand. What are thermal light sources? We talk about fire, we talk about torches, we talk about candlelight, we talk about incandescent lamps, and all these thermal light sources prove to you that we are, or that you are, fully adapted to the properties. Because talking about color rendering, for example, the color rendering index is nearly 100 for sunlight, it's nearly 100 for incandescent lamp light, it's nearly 100 for even a candlelight. And so you can tell from this fact that we are through the whole spectrum of possible color temperatures, we are fully adapted as long as we are talking about thermal light.
What you're saying is that we should be able to feel light in addition to be able to see light. And if you just see it but you don't feel it, that your body has a sense of unease?
As long as we focus only on our eyes, then we limit ourselves in a probably detrimental way, because our skin is a much better sensory organ for the broader spectrum of light. Our skin exhibits very specific reactions to UVB, for example. You experience an erythema, you experience a sunburn. Our skin increases the circulation, blood circulation under the influence of UVA light mediated via the nitric oxide, for example. Our skin senses even the infrared B and C part in order to give you kind of sensory signal that you might be overdosing the light. So our skin is able to detect the full spectrum. And if we make our rules only for the eye, then we become fooled by the light sources. By these artificial light sources which are made solely for the eyes. And this is the fact when we talk about fluorescent lamps, for example, when we talk about LED light, for general lighting purposes, because these are the light surrogates. They are restricted in their spectrum in order to save kind of energy in short term, but it will probably make us quite sick in the long term view. I'm pretty convinced that there is a great risk coming to our societies if we totally switch over to the non-thermal light sources. At the moment, it's the LED. There is a higher risk. Yeah?
What kind of risks? By the way, I agree with you. What are the risks that you've identified?
You talked about the circadian rhythm and the controlling system. We have some ganglion cells in our retina, which transmit a signal to the midbrain and tell the pituitary and the pineal gland what to do. And pituitary and pineal gland are antagonistic parts of a system. And if we, for example, if we have daylight conditions during the nighttime, then this is a detrimental influence because it stops or at least it hinders our regeneration during the night. For example, melatonin takes care that our body temperature lowers, goes down during nighttime. Lower mitochondrial activity, for example, means that your cells will store up fresh energy in order to have enough energy available during the next day. And if you cut down the regeneration phases by using the wrong light with the too high color temperature, for example, during the nighttime, you cut down your regeneration in the whole system, beginning from your cardiovascular system, ending in your retina, for example. And this opens the door for the development of degenerative diseases. And this is the problem we have.
So bright light at night is associated with cancer and degenerative diseases. But what about if I still have darkness at night, but during the day I'm under cold LED lights that don't have any thermal source? What is that mismatch between the heat and the light? What's that going to do to me?
When we look at the spectral distribution of natural light sources, then we have we have a part in the spectrum which is the near infrared or the infrared A. It is not detectable with our eyes, it's invisible, and we cannot feel it with our skin sensors because it distributes evenly in the whole tissue, and it only activates in a quite subtle action mitochondria, for example. And I don't think that people are able to feel if their mitochondria are stimulated via near infrared. But we can prove it. We can prove it in the Petri dish. We can prove it with animals, for example. We can even prove it in therapy when we experience faster wound healing.
Yeah, I was in a sauna last night that has near and far and mid spectrum infrared in it, and it does have a biological effect. It's hard to argue that it doesn't.
It does something to you, of course, but it does something to you because it comes in company with the infrared B and the longer infrared wavelengths. So you feel the heat, and this will give you some reflex reactions if you have the heat, which can be detected on the skin. Then it automatically will influence your blood circulation, for example. It would change the distribution of blood between muscles and skin and so on. But if you take the pure infrared, the pure near infrared, it's a indirect action. It's a long-term, mid-term and long-term action. But normally it's something you don't feel immediately. But when you look at the spectral distribution of sunlight and thermal light sources, the majority of the radiation energy is located in the near infrared. And the near infrared has one very important property. It varies very subtly, in a very subtle manner, activates the water molecules. And it's like stirring, if you have a rock sugar and you put it in cold water, it will take very long time to dissolve. If you start stirring or if you have warm water, it will dissolve quite swiftly. And so you can imagine this is what the near infrared does, not only in our skin, it helps kind of, I call this stimulated diffusion, for example. It's light stimulated diffusion processes which are activated by the near infrared radiation. And think about the conditions we find in our retina. The place where we see the colors, the place where we have sharpest vision, is the so-called macula lutea. It's a yellow spot in the middle of the retina, which gives us, let's say, 95% of the pictures we have throughout the day. Everything you're focusing will be focused directly into the retina, into the macula lutea, the dot or spot of sharpest vision. And the interesting fact is that the distance between capillary vessels, which are necessary to nourish the energy-hungry photoreceptors in your retina, they have the largest distance ever found in the body. No other organ has or exhibits such a large distance between the capillary vessels, which bring nourishing substances and which take away the trash. The distance is so large that it doesn't work just by diffusion. It is kind of reinforced diffusion, which is necessary to take care and to caress, in a way, your retina so that it can work over the decades.
This is important. You're saying that near infrared or infrared A is required to let the eye do its detoxification processes.
And I'm 100%, 180% convinced that nature was only able to construct such a delicate structure like the human eye, was only able to construct this because there was only thermal light around during the longest time of evolution and of the development of our ocular system.
So in your house then, do you have halogen lights? Do you have incandescent lights? Like what is the best indoor light?
The best indoor light, in my opinion, is a low voltage halogen light, which is driven with DC or direct current transformers. So you have a very low or zero level of electromagnetic dirty electricity comes from alternating current systems, and the direct current systems, they have no electrosmog, so to say, no dirty electricity on one hand. And what light is, the photons, they travel at the speed of light, so they are very swift and very fast on their way, and the consequences.
But don't LED lights also travel? I thought all light would travel the same way.
But they are modulated. The light coming from LEDs, I don't say that it's impossible to build a good lighting scene based on LEDs, but no one can afford it. It's at the moment, it's way too expensive. Because you would have to fill up all the gaps you find in a LED light source with other LEDs, which give you this part which is missing in one LED has to be produced by the other. This is one aspect. And the other aspect is that there is a good tradition of bad lighting, of selling bad light since many decades, which means you, for example, flicker is one thing, is one quality yeah. parameter of light. Does light flicker or does it not flicker? Is it a steady stream of light or does it flicker? And the problem that light is traveling so fast, and especially in the LEDs, which are semiconductor light sources, you can transmit very, very high frequencies using LED light. It's used in telecommunications, for example. Mm-hmm. So modulation frequencies of megahertz is not a problem at all for an LED. But this means, on the other hand, that you have all the dirt from the transformers, from the ballasts, the dirt from the grid. The 60 hertz transforms into 120 hertz dirty electricity in most of the ballasts, which are included into the retrofit LED models you can purchase. So the filament, the tungsten filament, is quite lazy. It switches on and off in a very cozy way, but the LED switches on and off in a very harsh way. And this is what makes yeah. it much more problematic. So if you, one in Germany, I cannot tell how it is in the US, but they switched over to LED backlights about 10 years ago. And I always have a kind of stroboscopic effect when I drive during the night behind one of these cars with an LED backlight, because yeah. they thought they were very clever in a way that they use only one LED for the normal light and for the brake light. So they pulse the normal light in a way that it has a lower intensity, and then when you are braking, it becomes brighter. So they change the ratio between bright and dark phases. And this goes on a certain frequency, pulse width modulation frequency. And you didn't have to care about pulse width modulation and any frequency in cars before the age of LEDs, because you had direct current from the battery and you had incandescent lamps with a very lazy filament. So there was a steady light. And nowadays, they thought, let's take 250 hertz, this might be enough. But for LEDs, it's not enough because it's on, off, on, off.
So for listeners, what we're talking about is the idea that LED lights, even if you can't see it, that they blink. And maybe you can see it or some part of your brain sees it. I've noticed when I'm under LEDs, especially older indoor LED lights, I get tired much more quickly. And I don't think I'm the only one. It's just like, wow, I'm not as energetic at the end of the day. It's very common. And they have new LEDs, though, that are now blinking 240 times a second instead of 120 times a second. And those are better. They're still not as good as incandescent lights for how I'm going to feel at the end of the day. But is there some number, like, do we need LEDs that blink 2,000 times a second, and then those are going to be better, even yeah. if they're missing the thermal side?
Yeah, exactly. It depends very much on the conditions on your habits of seeing the light. If you move your eyes very swiftly, then you can even see 1,500 hertz. And so the recommendation from a working group from the CIE is to have at least 2,000 hertz, which means 2,000 wow. times on and off. So you cannot see it directly anymore. You cannot see, even if you move your eyes very swiftly, for example, it's not only the, you know, that it's not only the light sources you have in terms of general lighting appliances around you. The way how the displays of computer monitors are dimmed, it's exactly the same technology. It's the same pulse width modulation, and you should have, in my opinion, at least 10,000 hertz to be on the safe side. 10,000 hertz means 10,000 times on and off in a second, and some of the computer monitors are already there and others are not. And so each time you just go one step beyond the highest intensity of your computer screen, you get this kind of flashing light. And the bad thing, the odd thing, is that it's on a subconscious level, and it's not per se on a subconscious level. Your brain has to eliminate these impulses.
Yeah.
And this is what makes you tired at the end of the day.
And I may just be more sensitive than the average person, or just more aware, but I really, I notice a profound difference at the end of the day if the lights are subtly flickering, and I can see when they flicker. And is this because I have a weak brain, or is this because I'm more aware of light? Do you have any thoughts about that? Are some people just more susceptible to that?
If people start learning about the property of flicker, they have the opportunity to sensitize themselves. And if it stays on the unconscious level, our body will adapt to mostly anything if we are surrounded by it on a constant level. This is the tricky thing. When you purchase a TV set, or when you purchase your new computer, when you take it home and you have it there on your table desk, then you will accommodate to it, which does not mean that it's beneficial to you, but it will be faded out from your awareness. And I think it's better to train this awareness. For example, what happens when people have to work in front of a flickering computer? They develop kind of lazy eyes, because when you move your eyes quite swiftly from left to right, left to right, left to right, we have muscles like that in our head to move the eyes. And if we do so, we can see the flicker. And
yeah.
If we move our eyes using our head and have a staring view, then we reduce the stroboscopic effects. And this is what happens, that your neck becomes stiff, because your neck muscles have to do the work normally, which would be taken over by the muscles in your eyes. But unconsciously, you want to avoid the flicker, you want to avoid the stroboscopic effect, and so your body changes the behavior, changes the pattern of movement.
So you can look at the cheap LEDs that they sell for Christmas trees, and if you kind of turn your head side to side, you'll see the Christmas tree strobe. They didn't do that when they have little incandescent lights on the strings where if one bulb goes out, it doesn't work. This is the most apparent place that I learned to see the stroboscopic effect, but I find it's in indoor lighting all over the place, and it does make you tired. But let's, in order to fit this into the length of our podcast, I think everyone's interested what they could do in their house to use either color light or black and white. So I want to ask you if I'm doing something that you would agree with or not agree with, and then tell me what else I should do. Right now at night, I have red LEDs. And these are high flicker rate, so that you don't perceive a flicker or stroboscopic. So after dark, I turn on the red LEDs. I can see everything, but I'm cutting out all the stuff that suppresses melatonin. And I use the Zentech screen protector that filters a small part of the blue spectrum out of my phone. So if I look at my phone, I dim the screen, and I've got a screen protector to filter out blue. is that enough? Should I be using green or yellow or some other colors at different times of day? Like, walk me through how I should put color into my environment so that I'll perform better.
Oh, this is a very wide field. And I think that comfort might be a little reduced when you just use the red light. Because it takes away all the color discrimination, and it reduces the full potential of information which is encoded in the colors. On the other hand, I say you do harm to your eye, you do harm to your system when the sun sets and you still see colors. Because we say in Germany, at night all the cats appear grayish or are gray. And this is how it's meant to be normally. And of course, the red light is the most neutral light. But if you would like to add some comfort, some vision comfort, maybe an amber light source would be a better choice. But still,
I do amber sometimes. We have amber night lights that I even carry. But I was looking at mitochondrial activation. So if you can see well enough in red, is red better, or really I should have amber? Like, I'm really open to your thoughts.
So during the night time, the mitochondrial activation is probably not the best thing, because in a way it could even counteract what normally the melatonin does. Melatonin lowers the mitochondrial activity.
Interesting.
In order to store up fresh energy. I would say it's all about you're comfortable with and you have access, what you have access to. For example, using yellow LEDs during nighttime, which do not flicker, you can be lucky and get the good ones. There are yellow LEDs with a quite broadband spectral emission, which enables you to discriminate between green, lemon, yellow, orange, and even red. Mm-hmm. And there are narrowband yellow LEDs, which give you the same impression you have from a low-pressure sodium street lamp, that all the colors disappear completely. And I think when you just look at the conditions in nature, what colors do we have during the nighttime, or did we have during the nighttime? I think humans and the ancestors of us, they used fire as an artificial light source since more than 1 million years. Some even claim that our ancestors had fire since 2 million years already. And this is what we are adapted to, and this is the spectrum from it has an emphasis on the yellow, orange, and red. And this is what was the correct light for many, many thousands of years. So we can suppose that our body is well adapted to this kind of light spectrum during the night. And this I think is very important, that we ask ourselves what's going on during the day and what are the colors we are surrounded by during the daytime and what are the colors we are surrounded with during nighttime. And there is a reduced color spectrum during nighttime, it's a lower intensity during nighttime, and the light does not come from above except from the moon, but this is a very weak light source, so to say. So the direction of the light is always not unimportant, so to say. The green, The good thing with the colors is that if you feel attracted by a certain color, go for it. And if you feel repelled by a certain color and you still go for it, you might be able to make some remarkable experiences. But the color code, for example, when we talk about the bluish light of the LEDs of some so-called full spectrum lamps, we might think this is a correct color for the daytime, but when we look closer into this situation, we would have this bluish light when we are in the desert, for example. And I don't think that too many of our ancestors would have been eager to stand fully exposed in the desert under the 6,500 Kelvin color temperature with the high intensity. So I think normally the normal reaction would be to seek for shading, for example, to stay under a roof or under an umbrella or under a tree. And so I don't even think that this standard of daylight, 6,500 K, is really correct, because it exposes us in a situation which is not normal, which would have been avoided by intelligent people. And so if you look at the computer screens, which are delivered by standard with a color temperature of 6,500 K, I think we should rethink our standards in this regard.
I've been calling on Apple and others to reduce the color temperature, because I think they're hurting people's sleep quality, and that's why I put the filter on mine to help cut out some of the blue, and I turn the intensity down. For computers that can be where the temperature of the color can be changed, is there a color temperature that you think is ideal? Because a lot of people could just tune that right now, or they could run an app called Flux that will do it for them.
I run my Apple computer on the lowest color temperature possible. It's the 4,500K. Yeah. You can calibrate the screen, and it depends on the visual task I have to perform on my computer, because when I have to select pictures, for example, when I do graphics work, then it's sometimes it's good to have the highest color rendering possible, and you want to meet the expectation of your customers, patients, whatever, those who look at the content. And when they use the 6,500K setting and I use the 2,700K setting from Flux, then this is a kind of mismatch probably. So it always depends on the situation in detail. But
so probably 90% of people watching this never change the color temperature on their computer. And you and I both do the same thing. At night, or when you don't need super bright white, I turn my color temperature down, I turn the brightness down. But yeah, if I need to see what something's going to look like when it's printed or when it's broadcast, then I'm going to turn it up, but only while I need it. And this would be just a piece of advice for everyone listening. Learn how to control the brightness and the color temperature on your computer, and just become aware of it. And don't shine a bright light into your eyes like that with lots of blue unless you need it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Learn how to do it and use it as often as you can, because each time you go down with the color temperature, your eye will benefit. By the way, it's lowering the content of blue, which is the aggressive radiation in the spectrum, the blue, the indigo, the violet. It's the aggressive part in the visible spectrum. And
so what does blue light do to your eyes?
I make in my when I give a presentation, for example, or a workshop, I show people, I show the participants, I let them experience the characteristics of the ends of the spectrum. I have a red LED, which is pretty strong, and I have a violet LED, which is pretty strong. You would use it for checking the dollar bills if they are fakes or if they are the good ones. So when you would expect that you feel warmth with the red light and that you wouldn't feel anything with the violet light, because this is normally cool on the water tap. You have the red for the hot water and the blue for the cold water, right? So this is kind of universal color code, but when you shine the red light on the lip and the violet light on the lip, then you will feel immediately from the violet light a very intense, tickling, aggressive heat. And this is this comes from the production of so-called reactive oxygen species, which are derivatives from the oxygen molecule, and they are quite aggressive. They oxidize each and everything they can grasp in their environment. And this is what happens in the eye, in the place of sharpest vision, in the macula lutea, because the light, the blue light and the violet light, will be focused into a tiny little point, and there it creates reactive oxygen species, aggressive oxygen atoms or molecules.
So a slight reduction in the amount of blue light, especially artificial blue light that we're experiencing, would reduce oxidative stress in our bodies.
Especially in the eye, but on the skin as well, yes. Yes.
Okay, and if you did that in your eye, less chance of macular degeneration later in life?
Exactly. Nowadays, the ophthalmologists know that the content of blue, especially after surgery, when you have your lens replaced in the elderly, for example, there is an elevated risk for developing age-related macular degeneration. And we know the range in the spectrum is between 400 nanometers, where we start seeing the violet light, up to even 550 nanometers still can induce reactive oxygen species in the tissue.
And that would include the visible color of blue light that comes off of LED lights and fluorescent lights?
The problem with the LEDs, in fact, is that they are so-called, the most LEDs are fluorescent light sources. They have a driver LED, a driver spectrum, which is fully located in the aggressive part of the rainbow spectrum. And the longer wavelengths, the less aggressive ones, they come from a transformation in the fluorescent phosphor covering, which is added to this blue LED. But if you go for energy efficiency, you will never eliminate the blue part, the driver spectrum in total. So you will still have high intensities, even if your eye seems to tell you that you deal with a quite warm light source.
This is really important. And are there blue filters I can buy to put over my LEDs that are going to take out that blue spike, even if I get less light out
of it? You can take out the blue spike, for example, with office glasses, with some sheets on your tablet or smartphone. But the problem is that under normal conditions, you will have a very small amount of reactive oxygen species generation, even in the red part of the spectrum, and especially in the near-infrared part of the spectrum. And this is the point. We are talking about something which is called mitochondrial signaling. if there is energy production, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the energy currency in our body, and this is the product of the mitochondria, and in order to produce the adenosine triphosphate, the mitochondria have to burn oxygen. And about 5 to 10% of the oxygen burned in a mitochondrium ends up as a reactive oxygen species. So if you have an increased activity of the mitochondria, you also have increased concentrations of reactive oxygen species around the mitochondrium. And some of these molecules travel to the nucleus of the cell and tell the nucleus that there are excessive amounts of reactive oxygen species around. This is the first phase of the reaction. And the second phase of the reaction is that the nucleus orders the cell to produce antioxidants. So you have an increase in antioxidant production as a reaction upon the increased level of mitochondrially produced reactive oxygen species. And the repair function coming from the long wavelengths is not triggered by LED light because it does not contain these wavelengths. So you have on one hand, you have a higher load in terms of reactive oxygen species generation. And on the other hand, you have a lower repair and regenerative stimulus from the light.
So properly formatted light is going to cause reactive oxidative stress. It's going to cause free radicals around the mitochondria, but it's also going to tell the mitochondria to clean them up. And light that has too much blue in it causes more oxidative stress, and it doesn't have the cleanup signal in it.
It doesn't have the cleanup signal, right, correct. There is also a difference. It makes definitely a difference where the free radicals are generated and where do they occur inside the cell. If they occur beneath a cell membrane, they will cause damage. If they occur around the mitochondria, this is what the cell expects. Because it's a constant load from the mitochondrial activity. So there are pathways of detoxifying the mitochondrially generated reactive oxygen species, but the cell is not prepared for high amounts of arbitrarily occurring free radicals somewhere in the cell, probably in the nucleus, probably in the DNA, probably in membranes, and so on. So this makes quite a difference.
Well, I would like to say that I'm going to go out and replace all of the LED lights in my house, except I don't have any LED lights in my house except for the colored ones I use specifically because it's all halogen and incandescent because I can feel the difference. And I'm really grateful that you took the time to explain what you just did about how we're causing free radicals in the wrong part of the cell. I think Bulletproof listeners will really appreciate this. And because this has been a really technical conversation, we'll either draw some pictures or reach out to you and get a write-up of this. So in the show notes on Bulletproof Radio, we can have some clear recommendations. But there's one question that I've asked every guest on Bulletproof Radio. And given all the stuff you know about lights, but everything else that you've learned in your life, we didn't even get to talk about the fact that you once invented an electrical stimulation machine for the brain. But just given all the stuff you know, if someone came to you tomorrow and said, I want to perform better at everything I do, like I want to be a better human being with more capacity everywhere, what are the three most important things I should know? What would your three recommendations be?
Oh, this is quite a question, Dave. I think keeping the balance between our roots and our ideas, bringing past and future in a way together, is not so easy nowadays. But if I would have to take just three appliances with me on an island, so to say, I would take a good light source. I would take good filters to make colored light, and I would take some musical instrument, because I think this is pretty much important, that we are grounded by our senses and not always focus on our eyes, but make some experiences which ground us using music, using vibration. So a tuning fork, for example, and a light therapy unit would... This is something I always travel with.
Wow.
And it's sometimes not so easy with the security if you have a tuning fork like that. And what I would recommend in order to live a better and a healthier life is to seek out for direct proof, in a way that I stopped believing what is advertised many, many years ago, and I started to go for a direct proof. For example, I would like to... we talked about Flickr. We should tell those who listen to Bulletproof Radio, for example, that they can use their smartphones in order to find out if they would buy a bad LED or a better one. Use the camera of the smartphone, and if you see the stripes walking through the picture, then you can be sure that you have flickering light in front of you, and you shouldn't go for that. You should go for the non-flickering light. Make your own experience, learn how to discriminate the spectra, for example, when you're wearing glasses and you turn your head a little bit to the light source, you can see the bluish twin to the center of the light source. Sharpen your senses.
That's amazing advice. I was going to add in there, if you have the slow motion capability on the camera on your smartphone, like the iPhone 6, if you film something in slow motion, you can see the flicker actually happening with low quality lights, which is even more indicative than the line you see.
Yeah, exactly. This is what many people carry around with them. So they have the tools, and they just have to learn how to use them, and then they can do some pretty good in order to improve the quality of environmental factors on one hand, and reduce the unconscious stress, which is which has the tendency to overwhelm us.
Excellent. Alexander, thank you for being on Bulletproof Radio. I really appreciate your line of research. It's very unusual, and I think it's very important. You've talked about effects, but you've also talked about why the effects happen. And where could people learn more about your research? Is there a website or a webpage where I could send them?
There is. I have a webpage, thephotonblock.de. There are some entries, some posts in English. I have a Vimeo Pro account where you can find several presentations in English. Okay. For example, there is a recent post from September from the European Forum in Alpbach, where I talked about light, and there are a lot of graphic pictures and slides in the presentation, so they are animated, and there they could get more information. And I have a spectrochrome web page, spectrochrome.com or spectrochrome.de. I would be glad to provide the correct web addresses, and the Spectrochrome page is in English as well.
Okay. I will put all of those in the show notes. So when people go to Bulletproof Exec and they look at the podcast notes for this, we'll link all of those things so people can find them.
Great.
And thanks one more time for being on Bulletproof Radio.
Thank you very much, Dave, for having me.
If you liked today's episode of Bulletproof Radio, there's something you could do. You could go to bulletproof.com and you could check out the Zen Tech filter for your iPhone. I've been using this for the past year or so, and you can get one that sticks on your laptop. You can get one that sticks on your phone. It doesn't solve the problems we talked about here. It's a Band-Aid that reduces a little bit of the harm. If you want to go deeper, you can look at replacing some of the lights in your house and getting rid of especially the low-quality LED lights. So we'll put together a list of recommendations for you on the Bulletproof website. And in the meantime, thanks so much for listening. This is something that affects the health of billions of people, and no one really talks about this except Alexander and a few other people like that. So thanks again, Alexander. Have a great day.
Same to you, Dave. Thank you.
I'm a huge fan of crowdfunding because it allows entrepreneurs to turn game-changing ideas into reality faster than ever before. Just like the company behind MVMT, that's Movement Watches, they started with the idea that quality crafted watches shouldn't have to cost hundreds of dollars, and they crowdfunded a kick-ass watch that starts at $95. You may not be able to see the watch unless you see it on YouTube, but it's already getting rave reviews from places like GQ, Playboy, and Ask Men, and it looks like it should cost a lot more than it actually does. So if you're looking for a watch that's casual enough to wear every day, and also formal enough to wear with a suit, don't spend $500 at a department store. Check out mvmtwatches.com/bulletproof, and they'll hook you up with 15% off your entire purchase. That's mvmtwatches.com/bulletproof.